So everyone knows exactly what to do, and it was had no problem with that. Don't be shy. Yes. More exciting? You want excitement?
Something that I really look forward to is like having a good snack.
Having a what?
Like having a very good snack that I love.
A good snack?
For a meal.
Do you know, this is not a sensory hit, the meditation practice. You have to let all that go. Because the real joy that you get if you're practicing well is different than a good snack. Much better.
Of course, yeah. I was just saying a metaphor.
Right. It's up to you. If you're diligent and patient, it will come. But if you want it, then that kind of wanting and greed is going to make it difficult. It will be an obstacle for you. You really have to approach this with an open heart and just a gratitude for the blessings of your life. Like even if you spend the whole meditation time just feeling grateful, bringing up in your mind blessing after blessing after blessing of your life, like you could spend 45 minutes bringing up the face of 50 people, 45 people. Spend 1 minute on each one. Thank you. You're a blessing. I'm so lucky. And sending loving kindness to that person. At the end of the 45, your heart would be so full of love. You'd be more happy than you were when you started, for sure. So this is tonight we didn't do that kind of meditation, but that's something you can do. I remember when I turned 50, I lit the lights at the stupa in the monastery in England. I collected 50 charas and 50 tea lights. I'd been doing this for a few weeks. I didn't tell anyone. I'd go to the kitchen, find empty jars. And then I happened to be on retreat during my 50th birthday. This is a long time ago. And during the retreat, on the night the night of my birthday, everybody was in the meditation hall. So I went out into the field, and around the stupa, I placed the 50 jars. And then I filled each one of them with a little tea light and lit them one at a time while circumambulating. And I made a determination that for every light that I lit, I would remember somebody in my life and send them light and good, radiant feeling of warmth and loving kindness. So I did that. One, I didn't rehearse this. This was just an intention I had that I'm going to do that. So I had to think, and it's amazing, I was able to think of 50 people. But while I was doing it, somebody popped into my mind, and I couldn't light the light. And I thought, oh, I have to work on that. So then I made a harder intention, stronger intention, and I lit it. But I also noted that I have to work on that. And there were a few people out of the 50. That happened with two or three. Then I went back to my hut and I spent the rest of my retreat trying to spread a goodwill to those people. Because whatever comes up in these kinds of practices, that's our homework. That means that if I can't light a light and honor someone that's been in my life, then I've got some hatred in my heart, or some fear, or some obstacle that I'm not free of. I think that that person is the problem, but no. The problem is not them, it's in me. because it prevents me from being free of that energy. So by consciously working on that, changing that to a positive feeling, I get free of hatred. And the whole reason for this life is to be free of greed, hatred, and delusion. So, but we have to find skillful means to do that. You don't just doing it by saying, oh, I wish I could just be happy. Our happiness doesn't come from wishing for it like that. It comes from actively engaging in that which helps to purify the mind, purify the heart of defilements. And we're not aware that those defilements are within us until we sit down to study what's going on in the heart. And we don't do that with a stethoscope. We do that with a mind scope, a mental scope, which is developing this pure present moment awareness that we can be our own doctor, be our own investigator, our own archaeologist. We dig, we investigate what's in there, and we bring it out into the open and see, ah, there's some poison. And then what's the medicine? The medicine is to acknowledge this is within me or within this being, and this can be expunged, this can be cleansed. It takes effort, it takes patience, it takes wisdom, it takes attention, it takes making space for that to happen. In the busyness of the world, we're too crowded in. We don't create the opportunities for that. And we follow our mental habits, and then we ignore and stay away from people that we don't like or that trouble us, and that could be wise, certainly. But also, in that way, we can develop certain attitudes and opinions that are a hindrance to our own well-being. And so each of us has in our own life a repertoire of difficulties, a repertoire of happinesses, and we're trying to balance them out. But at the moment of death, or at the moment of sickness, at the moment of pressure and difficulty, the things that we're trying to hold away from our attention are going to creep up to the surface and sully the present moment, sully our experience. The person that you least wanted to see is going to show up. What do you do? How much do those energies control us? How much does what we don't want pressure us into action of avoidance, of trying to control life so that we don't experience difficult things? Like, for example, our society is very cosmetically organized not to talk about death and dying, not to experience mental illness or discuss it. It's getting better on that score, I think. But so these certain topics are avoided, and people don't want to really know. I'm sure that many of you are different than that and are willing to, or you wouldn't be here, right? Topic is death and dying. So all of us are born, and because we're born, we're going to die. And everybody is very excited when a baby is born. There's a party, it's all excitement, and it's great. And very often people, when they're sick and dying, they end up being alone. Family will show up when it's really critical, but sometimes not. I remember years ago, many years ago, I was taking care of an elderly woman in England. And her her son lived in Canada, as a matter of fact. And she was very close to death, but not yet. So I called him to tell him, you know, your mother is going to die. Wouldn't you like to come and see her? And he said, I'll never forget this, he said, let me know when she dies. I was so shocked. I just couldn't get over it. How could anyone... But people do. They really have so much anger and resentment, grudge towards their parents. It's very sad, but it's what happens. So I was there for her death, and I remember her because I was a stranger. I wasn't her family member. I remember her saying to me, I'm so grateful that you're here. I'm so grateful. Like, it's almost like, who are you? Why are you? She did lose it a little bit. But it was a real privilege to give love to that person at the moment of her death. So what's the most important thing to us, for us to do, is to try to understand this, the purpose of our life, the meaning of our life, and prepare ourselves to die well and to die with wisdom and to develop enough love, compassion, and wisdom within ourselves so that at the moment of our death we won't be frightened and we'll be able to be there for ourselves in case we're alone, so that we can encourage ourselves, because we think that the death of the body is what, that's the end. But this body is like a coat, and it gets worn out, and eventually we have to just drop it. But that doesn't mean it's the end of our journey. It's like a course. We've been put on a course as human beings, this course of life, and each of us has a different course. Each of us has a different lifespan. And it doesn't mean that you're better than me or I'm better than you or anyone is better than anyone else because you live longer. It's just we have a longer course. We have more lessons to learn from this life. And this is not something that we should take lightly. But what really can be understood from the meditation practice is we can begin to differentiate between the element of the mind and the elements of the body. They're different. So what's important is not the death of the body, but what's important is the death of anger. And if we allow anger to die within us, then that gives us the freedom to purify the mind. Then the death of the body will not be frightening to us. If we live in virtue, if we live in truth, if we live in understanding of the moral nature of this being, it's not the being that rides in this vehicle of the body, it's not the body. We're identified with body, with gender, with qualities, characteristics of the body. Intelligence, education, caste, tribe, nationality, culture, personality. That's not what we really are. These are just like jewelry. Are you your jewelry? Are you the adornments, the dresses that you wear, the suits and clothing, the hairdos? Really? It's all impermanent. We desperately cling onto these impermanent facets and to the bodies themselves, but they're withering away. And even though we're aware of that, we manage to push it to the fringe of our consciousness in an effort to hang on and to keep things from changing. But this is desperate activity because it doesn't go anywhere. It doesn't stop you from turning gray or getting bald. Now that's become fashionable. But it's a very hollow, shallow kind of fashion, because it doesn't really win you any beauty. The real beauty is within. I remember, I always refer to this. By the way, I want to dedicate this practice, this talk tonight, to Martin. Martin was a dear friend of our hermitage, and he was a very joyful being, incredibly joyful, even at the time of his death in hospice. And Jill, you were there with him when he climbed the ladder to the light. Not identifying anymore with the body. So this is, and you know, Marty hadn't been meditating all that long, but he really somehow, the truth got wind of him, and he bit hard into it, and he understood deep things quickly because he was so sick. He knew that the body was going, but his mind remained very bright and joyful. He would come to the temple and have conversations with us. He wasn't like a dying person at all. I mean, traditional dying person wouldn't be so happy. But, and his joy was really contagious. We would feel it for days afterwards. So this is possible for all of us. That death is a mystery, but if we explore it and understand it by investigating the law of impermanence in our breath, every moment that we experience the breath, we experience the death of the breath. It arises, it goes on for a minute, a few seconds, and then it dies. What do we learn from that? We learn about impermanence. And then we can extrapolate from that. It's like a universal teaching. It's a universal law, the impermanence of the body. But instead of trying to keep the body in, don't get me wrong, there's nothing wrong with being healthy. But if we spend all our time eating only organic and having very exotic styles of living so that we look young, look healthy, look vital, look alive, and all that, but inside we're miserable, depressed, unhappy, resentful, irritable, hard to live with, insufferable in some ways, what good is that strong, healthy, athletic-looking body? So then it bears us paying attention to the ethical quality of our lives and how much we can die to our own greed, to our own hatred, to our own delusion. That's far more important. And if we can witness the death of fear, just think of it, to be fearless. Do you know anyone that's fearless?
Not quite.
No. Can you think of anyone? Anyone at all? If you meet somebody that's fearless, stay close to that person. Because there's something to learn there. That's much more important than being alive. You know, life can be very shallow, very empty, as long as we're caught by fear. And what are we so afraid of? What are you afraid of? I know many people who've said, I'm not afraid of dying, but I'm afraid of suffering. Well, we have no way of predicting how we're going to die. Probably many of us will suffer. How many people do you know die in their sleep? Pretty rare. But if we can be present now, this moment, breath by breath, even if we have to suffer dire pain, we can actually endure quite a lot if we don't add mental suffering onto our physical pain. And the physical pain is a moment-by-moment experience. The mental pain is in the future. This is going to go on forever. So that's when the freak-out comes. The anxiety, the panic, comes because of our fear, not because of the pure, raw pain of the present moment. It's because we're so terrified that this isn't going to stop, and we're terrified that we can't control it. So the ego jumps out and creates a panic, an anxiety that we cannot control. That's because this is not who we are. If we could control this body, then we could say, this is who I am. We have no control over it. How could it belong to us or to anyone else? Even the best doctor in the world cannot give us eternal life, cannot give us the promise of no sickness, no death. Why would you want to live forever anyway? How many more times you'd have to go to the bathroom and digest your food and cook your food, wash the dishes, meet all your relies? How long did, really, I mean, what meaning would life have if it was permanent, this form? So we know that there must be some purpose to it. Its impermanence has a huge teaching for us. And the teaching is to point us to the truth. What is the truth? The truth is knowing the impermanence, the suffering, and the emptiness of all this phenomena will bring us to a place of deep and lasting inner peace that has nothing to do with worldly activity. You'll notice that for the body to be healthy, you have to keep moving. If you don't move the body, you get bed sores, right? Just a minute. But the health of the mind depends on what? What does it depend on? To have a healthy mind, it has to be unshakable. The most healthy mind that exists is a mind that doesn't tremble. It doesn't shake. It's fearless. What do you do when you feel afraid? Yeah, tremble. A mind that doesn't flutter, it doesn't move, it's unshakable. So the more the mind can be still, I mean deeply still. I don't mean, okay, I'm not going to let it shake. And somebody goes up and says, boo! And you jump. Because we're that volatile. We are so vulnerable. We're so sensitive. We can easily be shaken to our toes, to the root. If somebody just mentions a certain name and a certain kind of bomb, we're going to start having negative thoughts, fearful thoughts. We're on the cusp right now of the world is just so full of insecurity. And that's why people have become incredibly busy. Do you know anyone that's not busy? Except maybe someone who's very sick. Most everyone is crazy busy, like never before. And also that much of that has to do with the information overload and the information exchange that's going on in the world, as if this exchange of information is going to make us more peaceful, more stable, more fearless. But if we can understand the truth of our condition and the conditionality of our existence, whatever is born we'll get old, we'll get sick, we'll die, we'll disappear. It's happened for billions of years, and it might continue for some time, it might not. But everyone on this planet is going to die. Everyone. All the phone books that exist now are at the verge of becoming obsolete. That means me and all of you. Within a few decades of each other, and maybe not. We might go all in one big bang. But even if we do, if our very last thought is one of love and compassion, then our journey will not have been in vain. If it's a thought of selflessness, a thought of wishing well to others, may all beings be free of fear. May all beings, including myself, be free of pain. May they be free of sickness. You can't say maybe they be free of death, because we're all going to die. Why is it that, understanding that impermanence, we don't live in the awareness of that impermanence? We live in this desperate search for the perfect moment, for the perfect device, for the perfect experience. One who seeks experience becomes the body. The quote from Muji. One who seeks knowledge becomes the mind. One who seeks love becomes the heart. I'm adapting. One who seeks truth becomes nothing.
Becomes what?
Nothing. Nothing. Empty. A total emptiness. Does that scare you? To be nothing? Because we are nothing. We think we're something, but actually we're nothing. It's because we're so identified with the body. We have to get beyond that. We have to understand more deeply than that. We're not this body. This is just a photograph. And it's, you know, if you look at a photograph on a computer, it's many, many little pixels. That is so close to the truth. We're just a conglomerate of pixels. And if you pull all these pixels apart, where will you find this being that you think you are? Which pixel are you? Are you the one on the left corner? That bright little tink, tink, sparkling bit, the liver, the gallbladder, your index finger, what? Who are you? Who? It's just a conglomerate of pixels. That is the truth. And none of it is what we are. None of it. So what? It's like none of it. Yes, it's in one of our provinces. It's like grains of sand just being washed ashore and then back out to sea. The breath. The breath is a wonderful metaphor for what we are. We're just energy moving, washing ashore and being washed out to sea. Waves of movement, finished. But when we come to stillness, when the mind comes to absolute stillness and can understand the unconditioned, that which is not conditioned by death, by impermanence, by suffering, then we know the truth. And the truth, when we know the truth, then we know that we are nothing. And in that nothingness, we're free. This is something that has to be explored. It cannot be explored and understood by thinking, but by investigating the conditioned realm. We investigate the pixel nature of this conditioned realm. And even beyond that, the nano nature, it's even smaller than, much tinier. There's a whole universe in every pixel. There's a whole universe in every grain of sand. And beyond, in the galaxies also, infinite, infinite. So truly we are nothing. When you put it all in context, you know that we are truly nothing. And we make a big deal about it. Storm in a teacup. That's why to let go thought and get perspective on our little mini world and see the nothing of it, it's a tremendous freedom. It gives us the ability to be wiser than we are when we're caught up in the vagaries of life, the unpredictability of life, and trying to make it so predictable so that we can feel that we're in control. This is just the play of the ego. It's highly deluded, volatile, untrustworthy, unreliable. And it's based on fear. Because we're so frightened. So frightened. Do you have any questions?
I have one. It's a little specific. But, so it would be desirable to have your mind or your thoughts in a good place as you die.
Yes.
But I think many people, I mean, it's like I'm thinking of somebody with dementia or something where
yes.
you're not certain exactly
where the mind
where
is.
The mind
yes.
is. Yeah. So, do you have any thoughts about that?
Yes. Bring a presence of love to that person as much as possible. Just to let them know they're loved, they're cared for, they're not judged, they're just loved. My own mother died of Alzheimer's, and I was with her. And she suffered for almost 20 years, and my father took care of her at home to his own betterment. He became the most compassionate human being to know, to be with, which is what she already was. And so what we discovered was behind the Alzheimer's, her mind was complete. And there were a few moments before she passed of total cognition. Total cognition. She couldn't speak anymore. She'd lost the ability to speak for the last 10 years of her life. But we could tell from the way she looked at us that there was this joy and radiance. We were excited and we felt so blessed that she wasn't with strangers. She was in her own room, in her own bed, with her family around her. So that we could return that look of cognition with, Mom, we love you. It's so great. And then she passed. So I think that the illness did not prevent her from dying a cognizant death that was fully aware and fully in its glory. Mm-hmm. But if she had been with strangers, I don't know. Yeah. It was just a real fortuitous. It was the result of so many years of compassion. You know, if you put so much compassion in, then the result is leaning in that direction already, you know? But if people get abandoned, then karmically speaking, they may struggle. But until somebody develops that level of knowledge, if you try to understand how this particular karma leads to this particular result, or why so-and-so came in with that and left with it, it's enough to make you go mad. So, in other words, don't try to solve problems that we don't have the capacity. But the Buddha actually only teaches us as much as we need to learn to solve the problem for ourselves, which is develop, refrain from evil, develop wholesomeness, overcome that which obscures the purity of the mind, purify the heart, go beyond. So that's the way to free ourselves from the karmic load. So, but it doesn't mean that the body won't die, because that's the nature of human body. So death is not something that troubles the wise. The wise have no fear of death at all, because it's understanding this is the nature. And what we really want is to learn to die wisely, to die well, to die peacefully. And we try to invest our life in activity and ways of speaking and ways of thought that bring up in us noble qualities. And we keep noble company. We try to pursue spiritual path, spiritual practices as much as we can. Even our work, the kind of livelihood, the way we spend our time should be of an ethical nature. So not using weapons, not deceiving people, not selling things that you know are of inferior quality, not trying to sell things to people who can't afford them. You know, it's like righteous action, righteous speech, righteous thought. Yes.
How do you prepare for, you know, like a dying pet, let's say?
You bring up all the good qualities that this friend had, loyalty, dog, cat. Have you got a dying pet?
Yeah.
Is it a dog?
No, it's a cat.
Cat. What's her, his name?
His name is...
Yeah, just feel that. Go to your breath. Go to your breath. Feel your breath. And just feel the tightness. Just feel that. And just try to breathe. You can't breathe and cry at the same time. Noticed. Impossible. So breathing is very important. But the tears are a measure of your connection to this being. And this lovely being, nameless lovely being, is probably someone that you have known from another life and has come to you now as your own pet. And you may meet again. So just try to bring up your gratitude for all the moments of friendship and beauty that this being has brought to you. And try to be there to make it comfortable as and loved. But don't hold on too tight, because pretty much our grief is based on our own sense of acceptance. The being is just going through its natural process. So don't hold on to it. Don't overwhelm it with your grief. But just bring it your gratitude. You can chant.
So then do you just embrace that suffering within yourself?
Yes, if you can, just try to be present for it and to feel your belly. Where is the tightness? Try to go to the tightness in the body and relieve that tightness by contemplating the nature of all life. You too will follow that being in your own time. Nothing in this world is permanent. And what we can do is honor the life that was lived instead of grieving for the death that is bound to come. Because in that grief, we hold on so tightly that we become not true to our true nature, which is not the body. That little being, maybe you can wish that it might be born as a human being, a higher birth, a possibility for a freedom from all birth. Because birth is dukkha, birth is suffering. When you're born, you're going to die. That's dukkha, that's suffering. So you wish that little cat not to be reborn in the animal realm, maybe to be reborn in a human realm and experience the truth that you can experience through your meditation practice. But you never know, it might be the last life for this cat. We just don't know. So we're grieving for what we don't actually know yet. You're not grieving for the fur and the entrails and the bones of this creature, because the spirit of this creature will always live within you. The goodness of this creature doesn't die. Just keep that in your heart. That's what we all take from the births and deaths that we experience over and over in our life. Is it why some little babies, some little children, why so many beings die prematurely? They're murdered, they're killed, they're destroyed, they're bombed. Why? Well, we don't ask why, but we take the gift of their life, what they taught us, with us, and make our own life better. We let it raise us up instead of deflect us and weaken us, disable us. So wisely reflecting, we can be strengthened by the gift of that life and honor it in the best way you can. Don't be crumpled up with grief if you can. Yes, wait, there was, sorry.
Yeah, like I once heard a phrase is that before we can truly learn how to live, we need to learn about how to die.
Exactly. Yeah.
So I'm just wondering what's your take on that. And the other part is, what if what we are afraid of is not about death and dying, but is afraid of living?
Well, if you're afraid of living, really, if you examine why you're afraid of living, at the bottom of it there'll be fear. We're afraid of fear. We're living in fear. So it's afraid of living, afraid of dying, there's fear. So to understand fear, to understand what we're afraid of, I think it comes to the same thing. It's to understand that the nature, the origin of our suffering is not in the world and it's not in the body. It's in the mind. If we can understand the mind and see clearly the true nature of the mind, then fear will be something that we can work with rather than retreat from or run away from. We have to do the investigation. We have to sit with our own experience and bring our mind to a place of deeper and deeper stillness so that there's no more ego and no more concept imposed on our experience. We just feel the rawness of the moment as it is, whether it's fear or grief or whatever suffering is arising, the pain of the body we can handle. But the pain of the mind is unbearable. So when the mind becomes so expansive through the meditation practice, you know, it's like if you drink a cup of water and you put salt in it, it tastes very salty. But if you put that same amount of salt in a bucket and you drink from it, you might not taste the salt. Is it true? Now, if you have a pain in your body and your mind is tight around the pain and resisting it, you will freak out. But if your mind is expanded and vast, then the pain of the body will be manageable because you have so much strength and openness in your mind. The mind can be vast. The pain can be pain. You can feel it, but you can be present for it. You can let it go moment by moment. It's not solid. It's like the pixels in the photograph. It's just energy arising and ceasing.
So can I see it this way, like every moment I'm dying, but at the same time, every moment I'm
birth? You're born again, exactly. And then there's the ending of that. And how do you want that the death of consciousness? It's not the death of body, but how do you want the ending of consciousness to be? Do you want it to be peaceful and bright? Or do you want it to be contracted and tight? This is really, we can work with that, practice with that. You had a question.
Yeah. How do you help someone who is dying, who does have grief and fear and regret and physical pain?
You can, yes, and?
And they're dying.
Yes.
And they don't have this.
A refuge or
they
a
don't
skill.
Have a refuge.
Yeah. Try to be a refuge for them. Just bring your loving presence, accepting, non-judgmental, compassionate, and tell them to reflect on all the goodness in their life. Even if they have to go back to some lovely experience, not what they're experiencing now, or if they're open to it, try to lead them in a guided breath meditation. Just, can you feel your breath? Oh, the lungs are collapsing. Can you hold their hand and ask them to feel the love in feel the touch of your hand? Can you feel the energy of love in my hand? Just feel it. I'm touching you with so much love and gratitude for your life. And can you chant for them? Can you?
Not in front of them.
Not in front of them, right. Yeah. But just that loving presence, that loving touch, if you can, if I don't know if you're allowed to put your hands on their forehead or somewhere, try to help hold the space for them. Very painful to die without breath. Foot massage.
Yeah, I was rubbing your feet today.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's very, just the sense of touch where there's a little bit of comfort.
Mm-hmm.
And you can give good energy through the feet.
Mm-hmm.
And a lullaby.
Mm-hmm.
May you rest. May you be at ease. May you be peaceful. You can tell them so many people are sending you love. You can recite the names of some of their closest. And yeah.
I was telling her daughter to tell her good memories.
Yes. All the things that she did for them. And how much gratitude they have for her. Yeah.
Actually, can I just add, when you do the foot rub, get some lavender.
Mm. Lavender's
lavender
good.
Oil. Because when my mother was dying, I would spend hours and hours working on her feet.
Mm.
And it would relieve the pain, sometimes even for 15 minutes.
Mm.
And you could see the peace in
mm.
her.
Mm.
So that lavender oil or whatever you're guided with,
mm.
just work under the feet, just rubbing the feet. It's just, you can express your love. The big toe
mm.
is the head, and just work with that.
Mm. That's great.
Mm. I also believe in lavender.
I have a question. Thank
you. He was first, yeah.
And I'm going to take this opportunity to ask you my question now. And I don't want to get semantic about it, but all I have to express myself is words.
Okay.
I have a deep conviction and have had it for forever. I'm not afraid of dying. I'm not wise. I'm not extraordinary. I just cannot find fear about the fact that it's an inevitability, and I accept it. What I do wonder about, though, is when I grieve for love, my mother. And I'm thinking here of Maitri and Metta, love. Love is love without attachment. I'm grieving my attachment for my mother. That's what I'm grieving for. That she died is a tremendous relief to me because she was suffering physically and had lived a huge, full, loving life. But that she died was, I had to now turn that attachment over into something that was without her. I don't know if I'm making sense, but I believe I'm expressing what's in here.
Do you think that your mother was her body?
No, my mother is in me.
Yes, okay.
My mother was the person she was
before right.
She was my mother and before she was born.
Right.
And she was much more than just that body that gave me birth and that, you know.
Yeah.
But when death, it was expected that she would die. When she died, there was the shock that she had died. This unbearable shock.
There's a big attachment there, yeah.
Yes. So then I began to think, but you know what? Love is love without attachment.
Well, unconditional love is, yes.
Unconditional love.
You have to investigate that.
Do you know what I'm saying?
I think what you can do is, I think if you meditate more and more and investigate that physical feeling in your body of attachment to her, that you may little by little begin to understand that it's maybe just mental habit energy in your mind, that you're attached to the attachment itself. And you have to unravel that and get beyond it.
It's been 25 years now, and over time I've been able to transform the physicalness of that love, her being, her body, and my ability to see her, to hug her, and to have her say loving things to me, and you know, all that kind of thing. That has been transformed into such loving appreciation for the mighty person that she was, the anchor of our family. And I think about it in so many ways, and I live it. I, her strengths and the example of the way in which the loving way in which she faced challenges in life that now beset me are my example.
That's good.
You know, and it's I love her, and I'm at peace with that. I don't have to see her shriveling and
suffering.
You know, like, yeah, age.
Yeah.
And this mighty woman who once smacked me when I was naughty or whatever, and had turned into this little calmer of an old lady who was with a wheel, what are those walkers?
Yeah.
You know, that stuff, that physical stuff is over, and now what lives is this huge person of great strength.
Qualities. So you can emulate those qualities and she becomes a teacher.
Yeah.
And you it's good to try to notice how much self-making and me-making comes out of the attachment, and how important it is to let that go, because all of us are just on journeys. You have that kind of presence in your life as a teaching for you on the journey, but you have to make your own journey. You can't make it through her. You have to make it on your own, and that's difficult to come to terms with.
But her example buttresses my ability.
Yes, and that's what I'm saying. Now that's a teaching to you.
Yeah.
But letting go the identification with yourself as the son, because mother, father, all these beings give us a sense of self. I am the son of, or I'm the relative of, and we feel loved by that person. And then when that love is taken away, there may be a longing for it because we don't love ourselves in a pure way. So we have to learn how to embody the quality of love without a personal aspect to it, so it's unconditional. It's not just to your mother. It's to motherhood itself, mm-hmm. to the quality of mother, who each of us receives it in a different way, and how you can embody that quality of unconditional love to other beings. That's really when the teaching would stand completely on its feet, rather than being weighted down by grief and self-concern. And through the practice and through seeing the emptiness of this self, we begin to be free of that kind of grief and grieving. There's nothing to grieve over. If we're embodying unconditional love, what is there to grieve over? We have to embody it in a way that's unconditionally helping and supporting all beings, irrespective of our relationship to them. It's just an energy that becomes a moral energy, a purity. And it's free. So you can free yourself from attachment through understanding that principle more and more and more, and allowing it to soak your consciousness. I do believe that loving kindness has it's like the oil in the engine. It can help speed up our enlightenment in a way that few other forces can. And it has to be combined with the skill of developing the five faculties: faith, energy, mindfulness, one-pointedness of mind, and wisdom. Yes.
So I'm wondering if you can explain or help me understand catastrophic thinking, like when your thoughts start to envision, sort of go down the darker hole.
Why do you go down there?
That's the question. I'm not sure.
Well, just stay with the present moment.
Mm-hmm.
And the imagination can be quite detrimental. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, Alice in Wonderland down the rabbit hole. Why do you need to go there?
Well, it starts off pure, and I was wondering, because I also didn't think I have a fear of death, but I'm wondering if this is somehow related to maybe there is a fear of death, and I haven't confronted it. So this thought starts pure, and then they just, you know, imagination.
Yeah.
Speak and get darker and darker.
It's really important to restrain thought. And there's a wonderful verse in one of the suttas that we gain mastery over our intention. Gain mastery over our intention. So you see your intention going, like supposing you're driving your car and there's a sign that says detour, and you say, oh, forget that. And you go straight and you drive off a cliff, or you drive into a ditch. Well, the detour said, don't go that way, but you go anyway. Now, you know, if you go into catastrophic thinking, your mind is going to get dark. So don't go there. Just follow the way of safety, the way of not harming your mind. And don't let Mara or this desire that is ignorant and unhelpful to guide your choices. Even with thought, on the level of thought, it's the precursor for speech and action. So if we're thinking wisely, we will refrain, we will train the mind to go down pathways which support waking up, which would support wisdom, which support focusing and using our mental facility, our mental faculty for waking up and being wise rather than being foolish and reckless or self-harming. Just because we can. We do it, the ego will do it out of a sense of, you know, just pride and conceit. Well, I can go there. I know this from experience because way back in, when was that? I think it was in the year 2000. There was an airplane that burnt on a runway in Germany. What was it? It was Concorde. Yeah. And 99 people were cremated in that airplane. And I was on retreat in New Zealand, and I thought, I'm going to send my love and compassion to all those 99 people. And so I spent days and days just meditating on this And I only found out about this because I was building a fire in the house where I was on retreat, and there was a newspaper clipping. People had donated newspapers. There was a newspaper clipping, and I read it about this incident, and I could not stop thinking about those people. So I thought, okay, I have to use my mind skillfully and send loving thoughts and compassionate thoughts to them. And I went into a really dark realm. I just went into this very black space, and my mind became so dark with heaviness and darkness, suffering. And I understood that I had stepped into an area that was way beyond my limits. So I just stopped doing that. I became really morose and sad and obsessed with the cremation of these 99 beings. Instead of reflecting wisely and wishing that they all, you know, realize a good rebirth and work out their karma in whatever way, I was doing it in a rather unskillful manner, and so I saw the result very quickly. But having seen the result, I recognized that the ego had gotten the better of me, and I quickly retraced my steps and went back to practicing in a way that was wiser and more grounded than that. So don't go there. Yes.
I'm hearing that there's something with like,
this will be the last question because our time is
I'm hearing that from what you're talking about, that lifespans seem to be preordained or like some kind of food festival.
Unknowable. But ethically we all have a karmic load. Unknowable, but ethically, there's an ethical component. And whatever purification we need to do, we must do it. And not worry, how big is it, how long is it, it doesn't matter. That's of no concern. We don't need to know. We just need to work at it as long as it takes. It could take lifetimes, it doesn't matter. Just
I'm hearing rebirth a lot.
Yeah.
We're coming around again.
Yeah. Yeah, we don't know, but we just keep working until we finish the work. Because it's such a noble work. Why would we want to do anything else?
Isn't that kind of the concept of being born with sin,
though? With sin. She's comparing, like, the Christian.
It's quite...
karmic load.
It's different. It might be in the same vein, but it's understood very differently in Christianity. But it isn't sin. It's just ignorance. It's just not knowing. So there's no blame. There's no shame. It's not that we feel ashamed. We're just born. It's conditioned. We're just the result of causes and conditions from previous lifetimes, because we were not able to wake up. But it's not that there's no one who's bad. It's an ethical force moving through the universe that is moving towards freedom. And we are caught up in that and are manifestations of the lack of freedom. And we just want to be in line with that principle of freedom. So there's no guilt. In this lifetime, if we act unskillfully, we can feel moral shame. And moral shame means, that had a bad result, I shouldn't do that. Let that not be what I follow, so that we can harmonize ourselves with the highest instead of belittling or downgrading. You know, let us download the best, right? Get on the highest frequency we can. We all long for that. That's what we yearn for. We don't know that, but we'll quickly learn that. That's the only way we can satisfy this unstoppable craving. You notice when you buy a new cell phone, you feel so excited, but it doesn't last. Then you see an advertisement for the next model and you don't want it anymore. So your ability to be happy with what you get disappears the moment you get it, because the craving for the next thing is right behind it. It's built into worldly happiness, which makes that happiness so volatile and intransigent. Unsatisfactory. But there is one thing in this world that is satisfactory, and that is realization of the truth. And it is when we come to the truth, we become nothing. There's no more wanting for existence. That craving it disappears. It's vanquished forever. So I'll stop there for tonight. Thank you for coming. Thank you for listening. And maybe we could do a little blessing chant and share the merits of our practice with all beings everywhere.
Sakkato wa Buddha ratanang Osatang utamang warang Hitang dewa manusanang Buddha tijina sotina Na santu padawa Sabe dukkha upasamentu te Sakkato wa dhamma ratanam Osatang uttamang varang Parillaha upasamanam Dhamma tijina sotina Na santu padava Sabe baya upasamentu te Sakkato wa sangharatanam Osatang utamang varang Ahuneyung Pahuneyung Sangati Jina Sotina Nasantu Padawa Saberu Gau Pasamentu Te.